Hey guys, I'm Adam Rapport, and you're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. Apologies in advance if my voice sounds a little raspy. It's because I had a big 50th birthday party the other night, and I'm not in prime form exactly. Anyways, happy almost Thanksgiving. This week, we are talking sky-high pies with the one and only Chris Morocco, who developed three amazing, stunning, towering pies. One lemon meringue, one banana cream, and one chocolate pudding for our November issue. And he talks to us about how to make each one of them. And, you know, if you're a last-minute decision maker, any one of these will serve you well on Thanksgiving, but they're also good throughout the holidays and, you know what, year-round. And after that, we have four BA staffers sharing some short written Thanksgiving essays. We got senior staff writer Alex Beggs telling the story of her friend's worst holiday dinner ever, thanks to her boyfriend's family. Digital director Carrie Polis tells us about how the most prized food at her Thanksgiving is hot dogs. No idea what that's about. Associate editor Hillary Cadigan does a deep dive on her family's cornbread casserole. And finally, digital restaurant editor Elise Inamine shares her experience of a Thanksgiving in Paris. One quick note before we dive in. Remember how a few months ago we launched our merch store at shop.bonappetit.com and then we sold out of everything? Well, we've restocked. So you can now log on and get our cool embroidered Bon Appetit sweatshirts. We've got the Brad and Yeti collab Werder bottles coming back in stock. We've got long sleeve tees dedicated to Brad Leone's fermentation station, one that shows our collective love of jammy eggs, and another featuring our favorite slurpable noodles. We've got the iconic Claire shirt. We've got tempering chocolate t-shirt. On and on and on. Oh, and you know what? For one day only on Black Friday, we will offer free shipping for orders of over $100. So get on it at shop.bonappetit.com. And now, here's the show. Chris Morocco, I feel like you are the only test kitchen editor who consistently wears their apron into the podcast studio.
I honestly feel naked without it. I know I need to let it go, you know, at some point, but it's, I don't know, it's hard. It's like armor. It's like, hey, I only came here to cook, dude, all right?
People online have made the Marvel Cinematic Universe Avengers comparison to all you guys in the test kitchen. I feel like this is like, you're like Captain America, whoever, putting on your uniform.
Totally, totally. That's how it feels.
Do you wear multiple different types, or are you pretty consistent?
Of apron?
Yeah.
I've been really crushing on the white bark apron, like the one we did with the collaboration the merch store.
Which you can buy online.
Yeah.
Good segue.
Shop.bonappetit.com.
Yeah, you want to tell us about it? Do you know about it?
Yeah, it's kind of like a hemp blend, like a hemp cotton blend. So it's like got a little bit of like a denim kind of feel to it.
Yeah, a soft denim.
But it's not like stiff, so it's actually pretty comfortable.
And it's dark and adjustable cross back straps, and it's really beautiful. It's not cheap, but it's a beautifully made sort of exclusive collab with White Bark.
Totally.
But you know what? We're not here to talk aprons.
No, we're not.
We're here the day before Thanksgiving to talk about your article in the November issue of Bon Appetit entitled Sky High Pies. And this spread, I open it and I'm just like,
that's it. Yeah.
This towering snow white peaks of meringue and lemon curd and the flakiest pie crust I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And it's massive.
We did all right.
So talk to me about this story. What was the initial pitch for it?
So growing up in my family, obviously Thanksgiving, a very big deal. Pie is a very big deal. But for us, it was less about pumpkin, apple, all those, styles of, sort of like fruit pies, double crust pies. My family lost their mind for banana cream. They lost their mind even for like the non-pie desserts, like the year Aunt Jackie brought a chocolate cheesecake to Thanksgiving.
Aunt Jackie, and it was like, way to go.
Whoa, what is this? Wait, maybe we can eat chocolate on Thanksgiving. I mean, still to this day,
what
there's
is
this
that?
Weird thing, right?
Yeah, I feel like no one ever has think. Yeah, it's got to be pumpkin or pecan or apple. No one ever does chocolate.
Never. And I was really clear about this story, just like wanting to pull in this idea of just like these exuberant pies, like it's just one crust on the bottom, blind baked, super crisp, and then with these like custardy, unctuous fillings, whether it's like the lemon meringue, whether it's the banana cream or the chocolate pudding. This is like, it's kind of that world of diner pies, you know, the ones you see in the case that kind of like probably not the best idea because God knows how long they've been sitting there. But
I like when they're rotating.
Oh,
in the case.
The revolving
you're
case.
You're like, oh, I need to order.
Yeah. So like, you know, I kind of just wanted to do a great version of that style of pie.
Wait, can I ask you a question? You're a Massachusetts, Boston guy. What's Boston cream pie? What's the deal with that?
Boston cream pie? Yeah, it's a cake. I mean, it's just kind of a vanilla sponge with a layer of custard in it and then a chocolate glaze.
So why is it called Boston cream pie?
Oh, God knows. It's lost to history, man.
Boston.
The knowledge is buried at the bottom of the harbor.
All right, let's start from the bottom. The crust. You had mentioned blind bake. The crust on that opening spread is just looks like it's about to shatter. What is the key to having that super flaky crust, and especially if you are filling it with something wet? I don't know if wet's the right word, but you know what I mean.
Sure, yeah. Rather than go with a standard pie crust, I mean, which this is a version of a pie crust, but I was really influenced by Stella Parks, you know, Brave Tart fame, who does a kind of like a higher hydration pie dough. So working in a little bit more water than normal gives you a pie dough that's very easy to roll out. It's easy to roll it thin and evenly, as opposed to sort of more classic pie dough, which is a little bit flakier, higher proportion of butter, but can be a little bit trickier to roll out.
But I would think more water would make it gummier and not flakier.
The water cooks out. It's just in terms of like how that you're able to handle the dough. So you go right from assembling the dough to being able to roll it out and then lay it into the pie plate, which is huge.
So you call for, I'm looking at the blind baked pie crust. It says bake your pie crust ahead so your oven is free for the turkey on the big day. Ooh, I like that.
Yep.
They will keep it room temperature. Oh, wow. Lightly wrapped for up to 2 days. That's kind of cool.
Well, that was the play growing up. So people would lose their minds about banana cream pie. And part of it was that my Aunt Denise would have two pie shells ready to go, baked off. And she would fill them fresh with the custard and the bananas that night.
Be honest, was Aunt Denise a little ticked off when Aunt Jackie showed up with the chocolate cheesecake?
Arguing about food is in the DNA of the family line.
All right, so you call for 2 tablespoons granulated sugar, 2 teaspoons diamond crystal or 1 teaspoon Morton kosher salt, 2 2/3 cup all-purpose flour, and 1.5 cups, that amounts to 3 sticks, chilled unsalted butter cut into half-inch pieces. And to that, you're adding, it says about 2/3 cup ice water.
Exactly.
And are you doing this in a food processor
or
by hand? Does it
matter? Just doing it by hand, just smashing the pieces of butter by hand, working in the water, and then you're able to roll out this dough right away and chill
the
dough.
On a nice floured surface.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You can use as much flour as you want with this just because of the excess, you know, the extra water in the dough. It's very forgiving, again, of like the rolling out process. You can use as much flour as you want and not compromise the dough. So it's great. You're able to roll it super thin. You're able to get it into the pie plate, rest the dough, not, you know, in that kind of like bulk, you know, kind of disc form, but actually rest it in the pie plate, after it's been already formed.
So you roll it immediately.
Go for it.
Put it in, then you put it, stick it in the fridge for a while?
Yes. Yes, exactly. So it's one fluid process. Unlike when, you know, you make your pie dough and then you have to chill it, but then you have to roll it. And the two things are a little bit at odds because the colder your dough is, you know, the better it is for your flour because it's able to hydrate, but then it just becomes a little bit trickier to roll out because that butter becomes very cold, you know, very hard.
Yeah.
And then it kind of fights you. So finding that sweet spot can be a little bit tricky.
Sweet spot.
Sweet spot. Yeah.
Are you wanting to do like the fancy crimping and braiding and all that?
I don't braid. I feel like there are people who are so much better at that stuff and that level of flourish. I'm detail-oriented like up to a point, but I mean, my God, like some of the stuff I see Claire doing.
Is it orientated and not oriented?
Oh, God, I tripped up there.
Emma, you want to look that up? Oh, yeah, so you just mentioned Claire. I feel like that's kind of a power move, this article. You were like, hey, you know what? Claire Savitz isn't the only person at Bon Appetit who gets to do dessert articles.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think I did it in a way that was kind of how I wanted to do Thanksgiving pie, which is to say, like, you know, screw pumpkin. I'm sorry. I don't have time for pumpkin pie.
Have you ever had pumpkin chiffon pie?
I have, but yours is delightful. Video's now out.
On YouTube, me and Molly making pumpkin chiffon pie. not dissimilar to these.
More
moussey and whipped cream topped. All right, so you've got this pie, the crust, you lay it in there, you chill it, you bake it, and then I guess let's start with the lemon meringue. Is basic lemon meringue? I've never made lemon meringue. I always, as you said, equate it with a diner.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I love a lemon dessert, and I love the fact that in November, there's very few fruits and things that are actually in season, but citrus kind of comes into season. And, you know, look, you can get lemons any time of the year. I love that it's kind of making the most of something that's just so readily available. And it's, you know, there's a cup of lemon juice going in there.
Wow, a whole cup.
A cup, yeah. So, I mean, it's tangy, you know, and I'm somebody who's very sensitive to things being overly sweet. So there is a really good amount of balance coming from, you know, not just the filling itself, which has a teaspoon of kosher salt and a moderated amount of sugar, but also the meringue itself, I put salt in.
The filling, how does it get so yellow? Is that the egg yolks in the lemon juice?
Yeah, it's the lemon juice, and then it's the egg yolk on top of that, the eggs and the yolks. Because there's two large eggs and four yolks in there.
So are you cooking the egg yolks and the sugar together and stuff?
So yeah, here's where people kind of, you know, get tripped up around puddings and custards and things like that. You know, that whole kind of tempering the hot kind of liquids into the egg mixture.
Yeah, you don't want to make scrambled eggs.
Right.
But you do want to cook the egg yolks through.
Right. So I opted to not temper. I am whisking together the eggs with the sugar, with the cornstarch, with the salt. I'm whisking that stuff together until it's very well incorporated. And then I'm whisking the liquid right into that.
What? In the liquid being what?
In this case, it was water. And then I'm bringing all of that up on the stove together.
Oh, okay. All right. Gotcha.
So if that makes sense, you know, so there's no tempering. There's none of that kind of back and forth. Ooh, heat the milk, heat the water, you know, pour it into your egg, pour it back into the saucepan. I just think it kind of makes it needlessly complicated. Using this method, you're able to just combine everything in a saucepan together and heat it all up together. And then, yes, get it to the point where it's bubbly, thickened, you activate the cornstarch. You have to get to that point of letting it bubble. That's what's going to kind of activate the starch and make sure it thickens and sets on the back end.
And then you take it off the heat.
And then you take it off.
Chill
it.
All right, so
you pour it right into the crust, and then you chill the filling in the crust.
So there's you have the photo and the opening spread and the photo on the table contents of the November issue. You really get appreciation for these. I mean, I don't know, what's the word, like kind of Tsarist Russia, the little turrets on the...
Yeah, like on the Kremlin.
Yeah.
Right?
We're both looking at Emma, and she's just giving us
Emma's just
face.
Like, I'm not looking anything.
But those little
today.
Sort of like onion bulb, like peaks atop.
Yep.
I guess we both went to college, but we didn't really learn much. So these look amazing, and they're burnished brown from being sort of bruleed. How do you make this meringue? How does it set? How does it hold itself? And how do you make these little sort of figures?
So the meringue is a Swiss meringue, which means you are combining the egg whites and the sugar and you're heating them up together. So basically that just allows you to dissolve the sugar and it gives you a little bit better structure in the meringue. So you've got your egg whites, you've got your sugar and salt. They're going into a bowl over a double boiler. You're just getting them warm. And then at that point, you're taking them off heat and you're just whipping them till you get, you know, that crazy high volume and the like really smooth, glossy peaks. And then from there, you can just dollop it onto the pie. What I love about that more like kind of rustic style you were talking about is, you know, you don't have to use a piping bag and make it perfect.
Yeah.
You can just do like fun kind of dollops of the meringue
like
on top of the
swooshes
pie.
Swooshes and peaks and everything.
Everything.
But you opted for this cool piping bag technique.
Piped kind of like, I don't know. Cowpats, you know, or
Kremlin
style meringue.
Pre-Soviet Russia. Yeah. So I do think to your point, you were talking about when you were pitching this article, if I remembered, you made that point of if you're not doing pumpkin or pecan, what people expect, you want to bring something to the table that's dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
That people are like, ooh,
yeah.
It makes everyone forget about that sorry looking pumpkin pie.
Yeah, totally. That sad little like, you know, kind of 3/4 inches of filling, you know, in there with nothing on top usually. You know, the meringue gives you that volume, you know, whipped cream gives you that volume. It's just, it's fun and it's over the top.
You were mentioning, you said custard, pudding. The next pie is chocolate pudding pie. I'm not sure I know the difference between custards and puddings. And
it's the same
one
thing.
Isn't one stovetop and one's baked? Like a pot au creme you mix and then you bake? Or
that would be a like a baked style of custard. I guess the one thing you could say is like there are stirred custards like crème anglaise, you know, uh-huh. like ice cream base,
yep.
and then there's starch thickened custards, of which pudding is a style of custard.
Okay,
you know, and that's where you're using some, you know, cornstarch and or some flour in concert with eggs to thicken a liquid.
And so this one, you're using both unsweetened cocoa powder and bittersweet chocolate chopped up.
Yes.
With some vanilla extract, whole milk, egg yolks, eggs, cornstarch. Why both the chocolate and the cocoa powder?
So the cocoa powder actually helps you thicken the custard and gives you that kind of unapologetic cocoa-y chocolatiness, that sharpness. What's really great about the actual, you know, the 4 ounces of bittersweet chocolate that's going in there is that it's going to melt into the pudding and then it's going to solidify as the pie cools. So it helps.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So you make the custard.
All right. I'm with you so
just
far.
Just like we did with the lemon.
Yeah.
You know, but we've got our cocoa powder. In this case, we've got milk, got eggs and yolks. So all of that is going to be cooked together. It's going to go to the pudding stage. At that point, you could eat it. It's great. But once the pudding is done, you've got your chopped up chocolate and you're going to put that into the pudding and just whisk it in. So it's going to melt into that pudding.
Uh-huh.
You're going to transfer it into the pre-baked pie shell. And then at that point, it's going to cool. And as it cools, you know, that cocoa butter content of the chocolate is going to help solidify the filling of the pie.
You're saying kind of in the way that like gelatin would sort of?
Yeah, almost, like leaning on it for that capability. I mean, obviously it's adding the credible chocolate flavor as well, but the cocoa butter content, you know, doesn't really have much flavor, but it's going to help make this thing more solid, more sliceable.
Oh, okay, so the melted chocolate sort of, it incorporates with everything else in there,
yes.
and then re-solidifies as it cools.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, cool.
Which sometimes you do that with butter. You know, like uh-huh. I have butter going into some of these fillings as well, because butter, like with the lemon meringue, that also has the ability to then set once the pie gets cooler
huh.
and then helps it become more
totally.
Sliceable and firm.
That's
yeah.
weird, because that makes total sense.
Yeah, totally. Like, you know, just think of like, what are these ingredients like, you know, at room temperature or cold, just leaning on them for those properties.
All right, Chris, gun to your head.
Uh-oh.
Flaky or graham cracker?
Oh, flaky.
Really?
Oh, flaky. You know, the graham cracker, it kind of came up as an idea. And look, when I posted my photo of banana cream pie, even people who've never met me were DMing me like, but you hate bananas, Chris. And it's like, yeah, I kind of hate bananas, but there is something pretty rad about a banana cream pie. And if you're going to do it, you have to balance that flavor. You have to get the peanut in there. You know, you have to kind of moderate that sweetness a little bit. So Carl and I were kind of going back and forth about, you know, should all three pies have the same crust? Is it weird for one to have a different crust? But in the end, the desire to kind of have that balance, that savory edge from the peanut pairing with the banana,
mm-hmm.
that won out.
With the graham cracker.
With the graham cracker.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I think I was talking about this with Molly when we were developing the pumpkin chiffon pie recipe. I guess one reason I really like graham cracker crust is that I think they're a much easier crust to master. That
oh, for sure.
It's graham crackers, butter, and salt, and that's it. And
totally.
Kind of anyone can do it. I've had a lot of bad to mediocre flaky pie crust that are not flaky and
yes.
they get kind of gummy. And I think a good flaky pie crust is like transporting, but there's
yep.
not that many good ones out there.
And I fully agree with that. And I mean, even for me, you know, I will make pie dough sometimes and just find myself completely humiliated by the experience. It's just a weird day. Dough doesn't want to come together.
Yeah. Could be more cracks. Humid than other days.
Yeah. I mean, look, it can be frustrating to achieve that level of like perfect flaky perfection, but it's out there.
All right. So then the banana cream pie, you're using actual bananas, 4 large, ripe, but firm bananas. So this is not some like fake banana extract
no.
sort of thing.
No, God.
So you're pureeing that? What's going on here?
No. So the bananas are simply cut up and stirred into the custard towards the end.
Oh.
So you know.
Gross.
This is,
I hate bananas.
I know you hate bananas.
I thought you were doing some like
two guys hating bananas.
You can feel free to at me.
So this is not a pie.
Wait, can I full disclosure here?
Yeah, sure.
I've never had banana cream pie before.
Really?
I hate bananas that much. I'm like, no, I'm not gonna have your banana cream pie. But it's homemade. I'm like, I don't care. I'm not having any.
Oh my God.
So the banana cream pie, then the custard itself is not even banana custard?
No, it's vanilla custard, but it's got banana all up in there. I mean, there's four bananas.
Why not call it vanilla custard pie with bananas in?
Well, because that's like what a good banana cream pie is. You don't want to like mush the bananas up. Like all of a sudden you'll get that weird oxidized brown banana thing. It's horrible.
Emma, are you a banana cream pie person? No, she just shook her head and went, ugh.
Wow. Oh, man. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, usually people kind of flip out for bananas and they flip out for peanut butter as well. For me, the magic of the banana cream pie growing up was that shattering crisp crust. It was the fact that it was a vanilla custard, not some crazy banana custard Frankenstein.
Because I think a lot of us kids also grew up with like banana jello pudding.
Oh, wow. You know? I mean, no wonder.
I mean, I didn't,
what did they do to you,
Adam? I didn't approve of it, but I'm just saying, I think kids did back in the day grow up with that. So there was banana pudding.
Yeah, banana is like an artificial flavor. I mean, God.
I imagine
didn't
even
think that was an option.
We're like just lost like several thousand podcast listeners in this last 5 minutes. So at what point are the banana slices put on top? Are they incorporated? What's
going
on?
They're incorporated into the pudding. So again, you know, you're making your pudding because you do not want to boil the banana pieces in there. You know, you don't want them to break down. You want, you know, ripe but firm banana pieces going into your wonderful, silky smooth and unctuous vanilla pudding. That's going to then get transferred into your pre-baked graham cracker peanut crust. You're going to chill it together. And, you know, this is not a pie that's going to want to hold up for 4 days. You know, the bananas are kind of doing things in there. So make this one, eat it the day of, you know, maybe the day after.
This pie sounds like my worst nightmare.
I'm sorry, Adam. We should have ended on chocolate.
Are you a person at home who has nice, do you call them pie server? What do you call the things that you slide?
Oh, like a pie server?
Yeah.
No, I'm the idiot who like spends 3 hours making a pie and then like hacks it apart with a friggin' serrated knife.
Oh.
I don't have room in my life for a pie server.
Yes, you do. We can get like a one little one, kind of a chic.
No.
Emma, Christmas
Someday.
Present. Christmas present for Chris this year.
Someday, maybe.
They don't take up a lot of room. They're not an appliance. Happen in a nice one. Do you have any like pie stands or cake stands at home?
We have some cake stands, yeah. Okay. We have a dedicated trifle bowl. We have a couple pie stands.
You have room for a dedicated trifle bowl?
When your wife
not
is from England
server?
And her favorite dish is trifle, you make room for the friggin' trifle bowl.
Do you have... Oh, my God. I just watched the first episode of The Crown last night.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
The new one?
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Do you have like a glass cloche for your pie stand or cake stand?
No. No, open top only. Yeah.
Shay has one. Christina Shay has one.
I know.
On her desk.
I know. It's at her desk all the time.
You could borrow that for the holidays because she does not seem to ever actually use it.
Yeah.
I don't know. A couple more questions before I let you go. Whipped or a la mode?
Ooh, I think a la mode.
Really?
It's a temperature thing too. Like, you know, like blueberry pie, warm blueberry pie with cold, like really cold vanilla ice cream. I just love on so many levels, like texture, temperature, kind of, you know, kind of juxtaposition. I'm not somebody who's just like, ooh, just give me whipped cream like all day. It's got to be in balancing something else.
I just wonder if sometimes the ice cream steals the thunder from the pie, you know? And if it's too much, I don't know. I kind of like, although I guess I like when you get a nice little canal of ice cream.
Ooh, and it's like still icy on top, but there's like some rivulets of, you know, the melted ice cream coming down. Ooh.
We need to use the word rivulet more in Bon Appetit. Okay, final question, because Thanksgiving is tomorrow. Let's say none of these sky-high pies are on your table. Pumpkin or pecan?
I guess pecan.
Well, I guess.
Pecan, it's so sweet. I mean,
it is.
God.
But if you can have warm pecan, maybe with warm chocolate chip pecan, so there's some dark chocolate in there.
Yeah, the little chocolate's good.
With the little vanilla ice cream.
Oh, that all the way. Yeah. Pumpkin, it's just not doing anything for me. I would eat pumpkin pie with a cup of coffee at 4 p.m., but to have it be like the conclusion of this epic feast, like you had like 8 courses, turkey, cranberry sauce, perfect stuffing. You're going to land on pumpkin? I'm sorry.
No.
I don't think so.
No.
Not in my house.
Chris Morocco, thanks for coming on. You can check out Chris's article, Sky High Pies, in the November issue of Bon Appetit, or you can go online to check out his 3 recipes for lemon meringue pie, chocolate pudding pie. Look how straight ahead these titles are.
Yeah.
And banana cream pie.
There you go.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, man.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Okay, so this story happened to a friend of mine, not me, a friend. One cold Thanksgiving, my friend went to her boyfriend's parents' house in the New England suburbs. It was a nice big house, painted a friendly yellow with a big yard. Inside the house was very tidy. There wasn't a lot of clutter or like family photos. The only guests were the immediate family, six people total. Everyone helped to prepare a totally unmemorable menu, the usual Thanksgiving stuff. And it was all very quiet and chill until the music began. Perhaps you know this song, Simple Gifts. It's been unofficially designated the Thanksgiving song, but it's a Quaker song. It has nothing to do with Thanksgiving. Let me play it for a second to jog your memory. Okay, sorry. So my friend recognized the song. She'd sung it in church choir, whatever. And she told me, now I know it very well. Because she soon realized that the song was playing over and over. The second time might have been a fluke, but by the third, she knew. After the appetizers and snacks, though, the family stood up, bundled up, and went for a walk. And they did this between every course. Eat, make small talk while listening to Simple Gifts, go for a walk. It was definitely the healthiest Thanksgiving she's ever been to in her life, she said, and she added that despite it being a long day, it was nice and it was unique, unlike any Thanksgiving she'd ever been to before. But no, the relationship didn't work out, and maybe that was, after all, the simplest gift.
It's the same every year. An hour before guests arrive, the yelling starts. Rhoda, you don't have enough francs in a blanket, my dad says. Michael, I have 100. That's plenty, she responds. Definitely not enough, says my brother Brian, who is occasionally a vegan, but not on Thanksgiving. It's not enough, agrees my youngest brother Adam. This continues for a while, voices raised, until my mom consents to digging for a pack hidden among other forgotten foodstuff in the freezer. Siding with the males in my family, I agreed to delay roasting the Brussels sprouts so we can cede oven space to the Franks. It's been more than 20 years since we started serving mini hot dogs, and I've learned that it doesn't really matter if I've made the pie crust from scratch or if the stuffing has homemade stock. The mashed potatoes can even be cold. But if there aren't enough Franks in a blanket during cocktail hour, Thanksgiving is ruined. Cousin Sasha barely eats anything else except for about 20 of the hot dogs. My Uncle Ira stations himself and a glass of whiskey in front of the tray so that he can keep getting fresh Franks as batches are removed from the oven. Last year, my sister-in-law arrived late to discover the Franks were all gone, even though she had specifically requested via text message to save her some. She was displeased. My mom claims that she has to make more cocktail Franks each year, even though the number of guests don't necessarily increase. As I was writing this, I texted my parents to confirm exactly how many Franks we make. Immediately, my father wrote back, not enough, with 3 exclamation points, which is 3 more exclamation points than I've ever seen him use in his life. My mom typed several paragraphs about how she's always told there's never enough, and it's really a struggle with trying to balance the volume of Franks requested with all the other dishes that require oven time, and how she's not even sure why she bothers making turkey. After this Thanksgiving, my parents are getting the kitchen totally redone. Most notable is the fact that there will be double ovens, one of which has already been dubbed the dedicated hot dog oven. Thanksgiving 2020 at the Polis household is going to be awesome.
For as long as I can remember, one dish has risen above all the others at the Cadigan family Thanksgiving dinner table. No, it's not turkey. Of course it's not turkey. It's my mom's cornbread casserole. The tastiest dang thing and also the easiest to make, provided you avert your eyes while combining a box of Jiffy corn muffin mix with a stick and a half of butter, a cup of sour cream, a can of corn, and a can of creamed corn. Bake at 350 for 50 minutes. Literally, that's it. Pull it hot from the oven and its surface resembles a picture of the sun close up. All gilded and crackly, with shallow golden butter craters and dark blotches where the crusty top toasted just so. Cut into it. All you need is a spoon, or you can just stick your whole hand in there, and it gives way like a heavy cloud. The interior moist and dense and studded with fat blonde corn kernels. Just robust enough to chew, yet soft enough that you don't really have to. Butter and bread melded into one. When I was a kid, my family moved around a lot. I'd made my way kicking and screaming through the suburbias of Dallas, Chicago, New York City, and Boston by the time I turned 7. Despite our many moves, Thanksgiving remained blessedly consistent. Turkey with gravy and two types of cranberry sauce, the jelly kind that retains the shape of the can for my dad and the kind with actual berries in it for my mom, stuffing, biscuits, mashed potatoes with a molten butter center, affectionately referred to as the butter surprise. We really love butter. Green beans with mushrooms and crispy onions, a gelatinous pot of peas, and the hallowed cornbread casserole. No deviations, no substitutions. Deep into adulthood, I'd make my mom's cornbread casserole for potlucks, revel in the praise, and share the many times forwarded family recipe, adorably modified in the early aughts to include one cup mum's love. When I lived in northern Thailand, I dutifully recreated it 3 years in a row, even though the process involved spending 20 times the price of a box of Jiffy mix on imported ingredients. Slowly but surely, I widened the casserole's circle of influence, bequeathing the Cadigan family original to the people of the world. Sure, its primary component was a boxed mix, but the recipe was special because it was ours. Or so I thought. Then, one day, not so long ago, I was asked to write an essay, this essay, about my strongest Thanksgiving food memory. So, as I always do, I did some Googling, and suddenly, boom, I was faced with a shattering piece of knowledge. My most prized culinary heirloom can be found on JiffyMix.com. We've heard lots of stories like this, Hillary, if it helps lessen the pain and the anguish and the broken trust factor. I'm on the phone with Howdy Holmes, the 70-year-old patriarch and former race car driver who now holds the keys to the Jiffy Mix empire, which began with his family's Michigan flour milling company back in the 1800s. You wouldn't believe how many times somebody's called me up and said, I've got a really great recipe, and it's the spoon bread casserole. Holmes isn't sure who first came up with this so-called spoon bread casserole. Its earliest documentation was as a tear-off sheet mounted to grocery store shelves in the 1950s. It was then known as corn bowl. Around 1970, the recipe was featured in the official Jiffy recipe book, and today, it's on Jiffy's website for all to search and find. I decide to confront my mom. She claims innocence. I got the recipe from a friend. I thought it was hers. She pauses a moment. Come to think of it, though, I'm pretty sure just about every one of our Thanksgiving recipes comes from the side of a box or a can. For a second, I feel cheated. Like something precious has been stolen from me. Or worse, was never mine in the first place. Then we both start laughing and can't stop. In my head unfurls a sizzle reel of all the memories this calorie-loaded casserole has provided over the years. Doling out second portions from my late great Aunt Teresa, a Catholic nun who'd scold us for forgetting to pray before eating, cooking with my mom while speaking exclusively in British accents. It's our thing. My boyfriend, Rob, burning off every last eyelash trying to make the casserole in a rusty old pizza oven at a Thai bar. He persevered. We're married now. These memories belong to me, even if the recipe doesn't. And there's something kind of warm and fuzzy in knowing that for the better part of a century, thousands of other families across the world have been making it too. Like we're all sharing one big old corn bowl of collective memory. Plus, the Cadigan version contains twice as much butter.
So when I studied abroad in Paris as an undergrad at NYU, I had three Thanksgivings. One was at the Eiffel Tower. Now I understand where my tuition money went. Another was with older expats who felt bad for my family-less self. And one more was with my two friends from NYU. I'm personally very thankful that I had some solid Thanksgiving meals already under my belt because the last one was a disaster. Together with our non-existent cooking experience, we made our first turkey in a very tiny French apartment with a very tiny French oven. You can't see my air quotes, but hopefully you can tell from my emphasis. I say oven because it was the size of a microwave, had one of those glass Lazy Susans at the bottom like a microwave, but definitely marketed itself as a fancy, space-efficient oven. So we decided to roast our very first turkey in this oven, and it did not go well. In the time it took the turkey to go from raw and cold to room temperature and still raw, we already made our sides and drank some wine. Right around when our turkey started taking on a beige hue, we started eating the sides and weren't slowing down on the wine. At a certain point, we realized roasting the turkey whole was just not going to happen. So we woozily hacked it apart with the sole dull knife in the kitchen and baked slash microwaved it until it was finally cooked through. I think this was also the night my roommate got drunk and fell into the closet, which both surprised her and made her pee her pants. She refused to leave the closet for the rest of the night. It was a great Thanksgiving.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wortsman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamine. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.